You're listening to a special recorded edition of The World Tonight with Robin Lustig in Beijing. We're at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy. It's a joint initiative bringing together the Washington-based think tank, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Tsinghua University, based here in Beijing. And if you're wondering why there is now so much interest in how China sees the world, just consider these numbers. China is now the world's second biggest economy, having overtaken Japan. It's the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, which contribute to climate change. It consumes nearly half of all the coal produced globally, as well as nearly half of all the world's annual production of aluminium, copper, nickel, and zinc. As for steel, last year China used twice as much as the European Union, the United States, and Japan combined. So this is, beyond doubt, a major power. And it's beginning to behave like one. Gone are the days when China was content to look after its internal affairs and leave the rest of the world to look after itself. Whether it's how to revive the global economy, how best to control the emission of carbon gases, or how to resolve regional tensions, what China thinks matters. So tonight, we're going to try to find out what China thinks. We'll hear from our distinguished panel of experts in a moment, but first I went up to the highest vantage point in Beijing to see what the world looks like from there. Well, this is the World Trade Tower. It's 80 floors high, and I'm in the elevator going up at the ear-popping speed of 10 metres a second. This is the tallest building in Beijing. It's a symbol in glass and steel of the remarkable transformation that China's been through over the past few years. This country's vertiginous economic rise has changed not only China itself, it's also revolutionised its relations with the rest of the world. With me here at the top of the tower is Victor Gao, political commentator and analyst. We're here at the top of the highest building in Beijing. China has arrived at the top of the league of economic powers. What does China want now from the rest of the world in terms of a new relationship?
Well, I would say for the last 32 years, there are two pillars supporting China's growth. One is maintaining stability at home. The other one is keeping peace in the world. And I think as far as China is concerned, it has managed to achieve both goals. And this actually explains the tremendous and profound amount of transformation you're witnessing in China.
But if you look at the relationship between China and the other economic superpower, the United States, and if you look at the relationship between China and some of its neighbors, we see friction.
Economically speaking, you are right, because over the past 6 years or so, China successively passed Italy, UK, France, Germany, and earlier this year, Japan, and is now the second largest economy in the world. Therefore, whether China has learned how to deal with this fast-changing situation and whether the rest of the world has learned how to deal with China is not certain. So I would say going forward, in this very critical transition stage, there will be many challenges that both China and the rest of the world need to handle very, very carefully.
Well, that was the analyst and commentator Victor Gao. Let me now introduce you to our panel of guests. They are Professor Sun Jie, Director of the Center for U.S.-China Relations here at Tsinghua University, Professor Xie Tao of the Beijing Foreign Studies University, John Holden, former chairman of the American Chambers of Commerce in China, former president of the National Committee on United States-China Relations, now with the PR agency Hill & Knowlton, and Jeff Dyer, Beijing Bureau Chief of the Financial Times. Welcome to all of you. Now, I want to start by asking each of you the same simple question. In your view, is China already a global superpower? Professor Sun.
Yes. I think China is more like a 17-year-old Yao Ming. And the size is big, but still a learning process for him to learn the international rules and how to play in a decent way and also in a tough way.
Professor Xie?
Well, it depends on which aspect you're looking at. Economically, you know, you look at the statistics, China appears to be a rising economic superpower. But then you look at other indicators of, national wealth, I think China still lies far, far below many other countries, in particular the United States. So I wouldn't say China is a superpower now, but I think it's in the process of becoming one.
John Holden, you've been watching China for many, many years. Does it look to you now as if it's behaving like a superpower?
Absolutely not. China doesn't have the military reach and capabilities of a superpower. It's a rising economic power. It's a very important, the most important regional power. But no, we're all very sensitized to whatever China says and does, and I think that amplifies the signals that we're getting and how we understand it.
Jeff Dyer. China's not a military superpower by any means. American military spending is probably 8, 9, or 10 times higher than Chinese. So as John was saying, it doesn't have the military reach to behave in that way. But what you are seeing is a process where China's shifting from a defensive foreign policy, if you like, where China just really wanted to get on with growing its economy, into having a more activist foreign policy where it's trying to shape some aspects of globalization, trying to get much more involved and trying to take a more of a leadership role. And that has some very positive things coming from that, but that's also beginning to ruffle some feathers in the region and elsewhere too.
But when you talk about trying to shape events, isn't that one of the characteristics of a superpower?
It's the characteristics of a big, important country, and China is absolutely that. But it's not a superpower that can really challenge militarily, economically, the U.S. at this stage.
Okay, I want to ask you some more specific questions in just a moment, starting with the whole issue of China's relations with some of its neighbours. It does, after all, still have unresolved border disputes with India, with Vietnam, the Philippines and Malaysia, among others, as well as with Japan over a group of islands in the East China Sea. You'll remember perhaps that in September, Japanese coast guards arrested a Chinese fishing trawler close to the islands. Tensions between the two countries rose sharply. So let's hear now what they're saying in Japan about relations with China. This report comes from Roland Burke, our correspondent in Tokyo.
Hundreds of Japanese flags are fluttering under a clear blue autumn sky. There are placards at this demonstration. Defend Japan from anti-Japanese forces. China is an island thief. These people are concerned about the growing power of China, about a territorial dispute that has gone on for more than 2 months now. And they fear for Japan's place in the world. Can I ask why you've come here?
I am against the ruling party. Most of all, I'm against the islands being taken away from us. Also, I'm worried about Japan turning into a worthless country. That's why I came.
Why are you protesting?
Japan's cabinet are not right in their doing about China.
Why not? What are they doing wrong?
If the people of cabinet are doing so, Japan will be the subject of China, subject country of China.
Is that what you fear, that Japan will be taken over by China?
I am very anxious about our country.
The incident which stoked the row was captured on video and leaked on the internet. It showed a Chinese trawler ramming Japan's coast guard near disputed islands. The fishing boat's captain was arrested. China demanded him back, saying the islands, controlled since the 19th century by Japan and called the Senkakus, were rightfully Chinese. Professor Keiichi Fujiwara from the University of Tokyo sees it as a symptom of the changing balance of power.
That's essentially the cause of huge frustration and an anger against China in Japan right now. It is as if the capital of the Middle Kingdom is now being restored back from Tokyo to Beijing. And as part of the declining power, many Japanese dislike that. The stronger confidence of China over her economy has emboldened them. China's getting stronger and Japan is getting weaker.
Kuni Miyake, a retired Japanese diplomat who served in Beijing, puts it more bluntly.
If you were a British, you may understand what I'm talking about. Just imagine that there are 1.3 billion Europeans living on the continent in front of you. And just imagine that those 1.3 billion Europeans all speak French under Napoleon, or German under Hitler, or Russian under Stalin. That's what China is all about for the Japanese.
Back at the demonstration, the protesters were being entertained by nationalist rap. Japan, the beautiful country, they shout. But it can no longer claim to be Asia's biggest economy, and a new order is evolving in the East.
Roland Burke reporting there from Tokyo. So let's see what our panel here in Beijing make of all that. Professor Xie Tao, fear, suspicion? You heard one speaker there liken China to France under Napoleon, Germany under Hitler, Russia under Stalin. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, I'm not a person offended by what the Japanese remarks, you know. On the one hand, when you look at the Chinese government's official rhetoric, it's all about peaceful rise. But then you look at this Diaoyu Islands incident, you look at many of these most China-friendly Japanese media. They are saying the Chinese government is actually shooting itself. Okay. You have been squandering all your talk about soft power. You are actually forcing the Japanese government, or at least the radical elements within the Japanese population, to advocate a change of the Japanese constitution. So I think the challenge and the task for the Chinese government is to rethink about your peaceful rights rhetoric and your own actual behavior.
But Professor Sun Zhe, what about the way in which the Chinese government portrays itself to its neighbors? Do you think that China perhaps ought to be more understanding of how it looks to its neighbors?
Yeah. First of all, I would encourage BBC also do a similar survey in China because we have about 350 million internet users, and also we have over 100 million bloggers. So if you do this study, the cyber nationalism here in China, you'll see that it's a very high anti-Japanese sentiment. I think the problem is probably China should make itself more likable. On paper, China is following that kind of policy, trying to be a friendly elephant to Vietnam, to those neighboring countries. And also the guiding principle for Chinese foreign policy is to pay special attention to neighboring countries and to emphasize a key relationship with superpowers. I think right now the problem is for China is something you not only you want to build up your national power, you want to be big, you want to be strong, but you have to learn how to be a benign superpower.
Jeff Dye, I like that image of the friendly elephant. Do you think there is a risk, though, that in the region at least, to China's neighbors, the elephant is bigger than the friend?
Well, it's very interesting. If you look around the region, what's happened in the last year or two, the Japan case is in some ways a special case because there are deep historical sensitivities there, but it's not the only one. The South Koreans are very angry with the Chinese over the way China's behaved towards North Korea over the last year. The Vietnamese are very angry at the way China's behaved in the South China Sea and have held a joint naval exercise with the U.S. 35 years after ending a war with the U.S., The Singaporean government is almost pleading with the U.S. to remain engaged in Asia. So what you've seen is a whole bunch of countries around the region, which in the last 18 months have started to get much more worried about Chinese power, Chinese growing assertiveness, and they're almost calling on the U.S. to remain in the region as a kind of hedge against China's rise.
John Holden, do you think that China is understanding enough of how it looks to its neighbors?
I think there are many people in China, and we have some here on the panel, who do understand that, and there is sensitivity. But you have a very complicated situation. You have every government is hostage to public opinion in its own country, and it directs most of its actions towards domestic constituents.
Does that apply even here in China?
Absolutely applies here, and I think you have these people who express themselves on the Internet about national issues. And the government pays attention to that. I think that going forward, one of the issues for people in East Asia, and particularly for China, is to look at history again. There needs to be more discussion among countries about what has happened in the past and get some of this stuff behind us. Because right now in China you have an education system that teaches people to be unfriendly towards Japan, which I'm quite critical of, and I think we need to get beyond that at some point.
Let's look then at some of those border disputes that I was referring to a moment ago. Most of them are, in fact, maritime disputes. They involve access to shipping routes, which China, of course, insists are vital to its global trade. A senior Chinese Navy commander was quoted recently, I saw, as commenting, "With the expansion of our economic interests, the Navy wants to better protect our transportation routes and the safety of our major sea lanes." As Jeff Dyer was just saying, China still does actually spend only a fraction of its economic wealth on defense when you compare it, for example, to the United States. But it has embarked on a major modernization program. So, Professor Sunja, let me ask you, is China, do you think, now trying to catch up with the U.S. when it comes to military expenditure?
I don't think so, as Jeff said. The Chinese military expenditure is about one-eighth of the Americans. So I think the right now you study how the neighboring countries, I don't see any massive these anti-Chinese sentiments. People still to want China to invest in their countries. And also, I think that you study the maritime issues. The defense minister of Philippines also talked to the world and says we won't put aside these sovereignty issues if we want to talk about it in Asia, not the United States with the United States.
There is, though, a substantial, particularly naval modernization program, an expansion of the Chinese Navy. What's that for?
Talking about the Chinese naval forces, I think I talked to one of the very senior American naval commander in chief. He says he can remove all the Chinese ships right away. You know, so that's
an unusual thing for a Navy person to say.
Remove, but he's very polite. He says remove. He didn't say destroy, right? So I don't think the China, I think, is trying to build up naval forces, and because it's, the country is big and getting, you know, so a lot of other things to do, you know.
John Holden, we were talking a moment ago about whether China is beginning to behave like a superpower. Looking at its military expenditure, at military expansion, do you think that comes into this context of superpower behavior?
I think it's normal for any country to try to expand its capabilities, and China has more means to do so now. The question, if you look at questions of peace and stability, you have capabilities, intentions, and interests. And I think one of the things that the way I look at China is I look at what are their interests today and the next decade or two. I can't see much farther than that. But clearly China needs a peaceful environment in its region and globally. It needs a successfully operating global financial system and trading system in order to keep the stability and urbanization process that it needs to be successful domestically, which is their main concern. So, you know, we look at intentions and what are they? To me, it's fairly clear that the intentions are peaceful today.
But it does mean that China has to keep its sea routes open. It has to guarantee its sea routes if it's going to be able to continue exporting in the kinds of volumes that it has been over the past couple of decades. That means, if necessary, doesn't it, exerting a naval presence?
I think that's in the offing, indeed. And nobody knows the future. What are the U.S. capabilities going to be 10 years from now? And so, yes, they want to have the options of protecting their interests.
Professor Xie, if one looks, for example, at Vietnam's concerns over islands in the South China Sea, the Spratlys, the Paracels, Vietnam is really quite nervous, isn't it, about what China is up to?
And for very good reasons, you know. Like I said, you know, you can say China is a friendly elephant, but to many other people, there's more elephant than a friend to the Vietnamese. But again, I think you look at Latin America and Africa, with China's overseas investment increasing at a rapid rate, I'm pretty sure the Chinese government one day or another are going to have a very formidable naval presence in Africa and Latin America to protect its own economic interests. I think that's inevitable.
When China says it wants to have good relations with all its neighbors, is it implicit in that good relations but on our terms and protecting our interests?
I think that's perhaps the prevailing perception and understanding in our neighbors, but that's probably not the message we want to send out. well, if you want to go back to the old tributary system or what somebody in the UK called the civilizational state system, whatever, I think we are projecting too much friendliness towards other people's understanding of China. In other words, we are overestimating our neighbors' understanding and appreciation and identification with our system.
Yeah. We have to talk about North Korea because it is very much on the agenda just this week after that exchange of artillery fire between North Korea and South Korea. Jeff Dyer, much of the world seems to be looking to China somehow to do something about North Korea. What role do you think China can actually play?
Well, China is clearly the country that has the most influence over North Korea. It gives huge amounts of aid to North Korea. It's helping underpin the succession process in the North Korean regime at the moment. So it is the most influential country there. But if you talk to Chinese officials, they will always all tell you that they really have much less influence in North Korea than anyone really suspects.
And do you believe them?
It does appear that the North Koreans are the one country that really do thumb their nose at the Chinese these days and get away with it. It does seem that China isn't able to influence events very closely there. But I think the interesting thing that might come out of these recent events is that we saw last year when North Korea conducted a nuclear test, there was a signs of a backlash in Beijing against this very close alliance with North Korea. You saw a whole bunch of academics come out and saying we're actually shooting ourselves in the foot by being an ally with this very unpredictable, unstable regime. And that conversation was allowed for a while, and then it closed down. You could get another debate like this starting up in Beijing, because a lot of people in this country are very uncomfortable that they are so close to such an unsavory regime.
Professor Sun Jia, what do you think the Chinese leadership want from North Korea? What do you think is the real depth of their influence over North Korea?
I think China is a very awful middleman trying to set up six-party talks, because China's plan is China is trying to tell other people we encourage three steps. One is North Korea need to talk to the United States, because it's the United States who is favoring sanctions against North Korea. The second step, maybe we have an informal talk within six-party framework. Then we have a six-party talk. But the United States position is something like North Korea should talk to South Korea first. You know, as you see this incidents yesterday, and there is no way out for right now. So the problem for China is you prepare a nice dinner. You were expecting five other members, guests, to come. But there's a traffic, you know. So I think it's still, I think China has a very good intention.
Xie Tao, how does China react when Western leaders say publicly and privately to China, do something about North Korea?
I think they probably have two reactions. Number one, very happy. You know, after all, this shows we have influence, we have leverage. Number two, they also get very anxious, especially with the Washingtonians, you know, people in White House and Pentagon. I personally have been very highly critical of the Chinese government's relationship with North Korea. I think by being very close to a regime that is widely condemned and marginalizing the national community, that kind of damages China's international image, how other people perceive China itself. Second, you also complicated relations, especially China's relationship with South Korea, with Japan, and with the United States. And besides, like Jeff just mentioned, today the Chinese sometimes even they don't know whether we do have leverage over the North Koreans. When they reveal that they have this new uranium enrichment facilities, I don't know if our intelligence know that what was going on there.
You think they may not have been aware that that was being built?
That's my guess. You know, anything could happen. Yeah.
John Holden, Washington in particular, seems to really look to China, doesn't it, to somehow sort out the North Korea issue. How do you think China reacts to that kind of pressure?
Well, I think they do less than in the past. I mean, I think it's been proven over the last number of years that China's influence does have limitations, and its interests are not to see a power vacuum on its borders. So I think at one point China looked at the question of regime change in North Korea. How would you do that? They got into some practical questions. That's not a puzzle that they could have solved. So I think Washington is is resigned to a kind of a status quo here, which hopefully doesn't erupt into a dangerous situation, which is it's threatened to do today. My guess is that China does have the influence to get the North to stand down and not to take this any further. That seems to have been the case in the past, but beyond that, I don't know if they have enough influence to make any dramatic changes.
Let's shift the discussion a little bit now and look at the global economy, because that is something where China is very much center stage, particularly when it comes to exchange rate policy. The U.S. has complained for years now that China has been deliberately undervaluing its currency, hoping to give its exporters what to America looks like an unfair advantage. I saw a member of the Monetary Policy Committee of the Chinese Central Bank quoted just the other day as saying that there may, in fact, now be an argument for allowing the Chinese currency to appreciate against the dollar by something like 3 to 5% as a way of dealing with domestic inflation, not necessarily with global trade imbalances. So, John Holden, let me come back to you. If indeed that were to be the case, if the Chinese currency were to appreciate by, let's say, 5%, would that make Washington happier?
To some extent, yes. I don't think we're going to come up with a magic solution to an immediate solution to global imbalances of the scale that we have right now. So it's not just an exchange rate issue. There are a lot of deep structural questions here. And the U.S. is also interested deeply in intellectual property protection. We want to be able to sell more high technology products to China and not worry about them being copied. So there's a whole range of issues in the trade relationship that need to be addressed.
But, Professor Sunjia, there has been, I detect, I think, a degree of resentment here in China, hasn't there, at the consistent, constant refrain from Washington, do something about your currency.
Yes. I visited D.C. Last month, and one American policymaker told me China should do it, repeat itself, what China did in 1990s. Increase 1% every month. So after do it for 3 to 4 years. So his rationale is after 15 years, even back to 2005, 2008, China increased probably annual rate is about 7 to 8%. So the RMB issue has revalued more than around 25%. He says you still have built up foreign reserves. Your economy looks so good. So why didn't you do it again? I think the Americans are expecting we revalue RMB to 30 to 40%. So that's a problem. We worry about the unemployment. When George Bush Jr. published his memoir, and he asked Hu Jintao so what he worried about. And President Hu Jintao says, I worry about we have probably 20 million people about unemployment. So that number is huge.
But let's just talk through the relationship between an exchange rate and unemployment. The reasoning goes, if the renminbi went up in value, then fewer Chinese goods would be exported because they'd be more expensive, therefore fewer Chinese workers would be in work.
Yes, that's the logic, and because especially in Canton and the Yangtze Delta area.
Jeff Dyer, I saw a Chinese official quoted recently as saying that the argument that came from the West on this issue sounded to him a bit like saying, we're sick, so we want you to take the medicine. Does that sound fair to you? Is that how it does look to a lot of Chinese officials?
That's certainly how some of them see it, but they're a real danger of shooting themselves in the foot here. China really doesn't want to give in to this U.S. pressure to appreciate its currency more strongly. It doesn't want to be seen to be giving in to this pressure. But China now has a very big potential inflation problem. It's picking up very rapidly. Food prices are going up. And inflation is the one thing that could really destabilize the Chinese boom over the next few years. And a higher exchange rate is absolutely one of the policies they should be pursuing to sort out their own domestic problems to dampen down this inflation. So it's very much in their own interests to be appreciating the currency, regardless of what Washington's telling them to do or not.
Xie Tao, when we talk about economic policy making, it does raise the question of China's involvement with some of the major global financial institutions, the International Monetary Fund, for example. What are your thoughts on how China wishes to relate to those kinds of institutions? Does it want to play a full part in them as they are now with the current rules in existence, or does it want to find some way of changing the whole structure of international finance and regulation?
Well, on this, I think the Chinese government's position has been that we want to join these institutions and we want to have a larger share of say, especially in terms of, for example, an IMF, a World Bank. You know, we are paying an increasing large number of membership dues, but we do not have an equal weight in policy decision making. I think that's one thing the government has been pursuing. Second, I think this goes back to John Eikenberry's point. Western institutions are easy to join, but very difficult to overthrow. So that's why Westerners should not worry too much about China's membership in increasing number of international organizations. These institutions are easy to join, but very hard to overthrow.
But do you believe that Chinese leaders see it as being in China's interests to play a significant and influential role in those institutions?
Well, I think that sometimes Beijing is being accused of playing double standards. On the one hand, you want to have a larger say in IMF and World Bank. On the other hand, when it comes to financial crises, when foreign countries or IMF or World Bank need you to contribute to, say, a crisis management fund, the Chinese government began to have second thoughts. So I think Beijing has often been accused of playing double standards on this.
John Holden, accused fairly or not?
I think it's a process China's going through. They've been asked by Bob Zoellick a number of years ago to be a responsible stakeholder in the world order. The very fact of their economic growth and stature means that they are being more influential. And a lot of these things are negotiations. And so you want to get an advantage. If you're working with the IMF, you want to have something to say there. You want to be able to influence how they operate. The G20 has already become the group that is the most significant, and that's because of China's role. And so these things are shifting. They're evolutionary, and we've all got to get smarter about how we negotiate with each other.
It does raise a very important question, though, about the way in which these relationships operate. There are people who think that if one country, China, becomes more powerful, that must necessarily mean that another country or other countries become less powerful. In other words, that it is a kind of zero-sum game. There is only so much power to go around. Sunja, do you think that as China does become wealthier, more powerful, that will inevitably mean that other powers become less powerful?
I wonder if you can give me an example. What's in your mind?
What is in my mind is a fear that is expressed sometimes in Washington by legislators that a powerful China, a more powerful China, means a less powerful United States.
Yeah, there is some kind of an internal debate here, and because some people calculated by purchasing power that standard, maybe in about 10 years, where China will catch up with the United States. My personal guess is probably it takes another 50 to 100 years, because even you have a good hardware, you need to build up software, and also I think China is searching its soul. It doesn't matter how you see other countries becoming less powerful. I think the longest journey is journey inward. We have to shed off our undemocratic, the way of the governing. So it takes probably 50 to 100 years.
Xie Tao, do you think it's a zero-sum game?
It all depends on your, which kind of IR theory you buy into, But again, I want to go back to this point about, United States and China relationship and the rise of China. I think there are two points that are sometimes overblown and two points that are sometimes underestimated. One is, I think China's threat is too much overblown. It's overestimated. And also overestimated is the U.S. decline. I think the United States is just in relative decline. And so this goes back to another point about this underestimation. I think many China scholars tend to underestimate China's challenges, particularly its domestic challenges. Economic restructuring, for example, the very subtle change of wording in the 12th five-year plan, you can see we use the word inclusive growth. We're not single-minded or obsessed with GDP growth anymore.
What does inclusive growth mean?
Inclusive means you have more, you know, social redistribution. We are aware that we are seeing a widening income gap. We are trying to address that. A second point that this goes at economic challenges, environment challenges. So we do have many domestic challenges. These sometimes are very much underestimated. And another point is about underestimation of U.S. influence. And this goes back to my point about institutions. Both U.S. domestic institutional resilience and resurgence and also international institutions. So these are the two points I want to say about.
I do want to give our audience an opportunity to ask their questions in just a second. But before I do that, there's one last issue that I would like to raise, and that's the whole question of China's investment policies in the developing world, especially in Africa, because it is often alleged from Western capitals that when China pumps billions into many African nations, it has either no interest or far less interest than Western powers would like it to have in, for example, standards of governance, levels of corruption, or indeed human rights. Sunja, how do you see China's attitude towards those sorts of issues when it's making investment decisions in Africa?
First of all, I think China also wants to invest in the United States, but because of laws and because some of the Americans are afraid of in the name of protecting national security, so there's no way out. So China put a lot of money into Africa. I think the lessons we should learn is how to build up a local community. Especially how do you contribute building up more hospitals, more schools, and to learn from the African people, learn from their culture. You know, so that's localized. The business practice is very, very important for Chinese companies.
So when Western leaders say to China, let's take Sudan as an example, why aren't you doing more to try to put pressure on the government in Khartoum to resolve the disputes in Sudan, to improve standards of governance, instead of just pumping billions of dollars into Sudan without any conditions at all? How does China respond?
I think China changed its policy of Sudan towards Sudan about 18 months ago. So it's quite different from what is being criticized back to 5 years ago. You know, so China realized the problem and trying to build up good relations. And also, I think China care about the Western criticism, doesn't want to be damaged, its image to be damaged.
Jeff Dyer, how do you read China in the developing world?
I mean, some of these criticisms about China fostering corruption in Africa and so on are fair, but I think I'd make two points. First of all, we have to have a certain amount of humility, we in the sense of Western countries, when we think about these issues. I mean, I think we have to reflect on the fact that we've done a pretty lousy job over the last 4 or 5 decades in terms of fostering development and aid and so on in Africa. And we've imposed every decade there seems to be a new different idea, a new different plan that we've tried to push on the continent over the last 40, 50 years, and few of them have really worked out very well. So I think we need to take a step back and just be a bit humble when we talk about this. And also, I think we also have to reflect on the fact that China is a huge potential opportunity for lots of African countries. African growth rates in the last few years have picked up quite dramatically, and a lot of that is to do with Chinese demand. And so, you know, China will, in countries that are badly governed in Africa, Chinese investment and Chinese money could actually exacerbate some of those problems. But I think in the broader picture, China is a huge potential opportunity for Africa. It's not a bad thing.
Xie Tao, how does China react when some people in Africa, I've seen it said from Zambia, for example, quite recently in the context of copper mining interests, that China is the new imperial power in Africa? It's doing just the same in Africa as the Western powers did in the 19th century.
Well, I think the prevailing accusation against Beijing is that we don't care about human rights standards, we don't care about governance. But the matter of fact is that, you know, I give you one example. A tobacco company wants to give you money, and you are a foundation, and you say your mission is to take care of unfairly treated women, women who are in poverty-stricken area. Would you take the money or not? I think the Chinese government is basically in the same process of thinking. We do want to help some of these less developed countries in the world. But on the other hand, we cannot just go there value-free. It's like we are, as scholars, we are supposed to be value-free. But when you invest in Africa, you cannot be completely value-free. you choose Latin America or Africa, a particular country, more or less out of some political motivations. You cannot say China's investment in Latin America or Africa is completely value-free. Our businessmen are private businessmen. They go there out of their own choice. The government has no intervention in their decisions. No, you cannot make that assertion. So I think the challenge for Chinese government is that because many of these companies who invest in Latin America and Africa are state-owned enterprises, and therefore it's very hard to say for you to say that I have no relationship with these companies.
John Holton, I mean, let's be blunt about this. The accusation that is sometimes made is that all China cares about in Africa is getting the minerals, getting the raw materials, getting what it needs to continue with its economic growth. Now, some people will argue that's what any investment is about. That's the way the world works. Do you think China is substantially different in its attitudes to anybody else?
I'd like to echo what Chetel just said a moment ago, because there are a lot of different economic actors in Africa. This is not, there isn't a central commissariat that's deciding, okay, here's how we're going to exploit Africa. There are opportunities and people are seizing them. There isn't a lot of awareness of some of the image issues and some of the governance and by some of these economic actors. I think Beijing, the government is becoming attuned to this increasingly, as Sun just said a moment ago. And I think there's a learning curve. But if you look even at Chinese business people and businesses here in China, there are abuses of labor rights in China. And you say, well, why can't the Chinese government do something in its own country? Well, it's complicated. It's not that easy. This is an economy that has population 4.5 times that of the United States. This is a very, very big, complicated place.
Let's see what the audience would like to contribute to this discussion. If you would like to raise your hands, I will take as many questions as I can in the time available. Don't be bashful. First question, please.
Benjamin Kreutzfeldt, PhD student of political science. I was very interested. I wondered whether the problem is not realities but images and the difference. I heard here about a friendly elephant. On the other hand, there was the mention of a dragon in the title of your book, Professor Xie. The dragon, for instance, in China is a friendly, powerful animal, and in the West eats princesses and destroys castles and is killed ultimately by St. George. So maybe we have there a difficulty in perceptions. And Professor Sun, you mentioned a 17-year-old, comparing China to a 17-year-old, an adolescent. When I say that as a foreigner, and they say, but we're 5,000 years old, and people are a little indignant. So I wonder whether there is another image, perhaps the elephant, so that we can adjust perceptions of China of itself and perceptions abroad.
Professor Xie, would you like to just talk about the image, China's image of itself, perhaps?
First, a word of clarification. When we decided on the title, you know, Living with the Dragon, we had some serious thinking about this. But you know, eventually, I was told by my co-author Ben Page at Northwestern. He said, "You know what? You know, the image of dragon has been changing in the United States. Now it's a different image of a dragon. So that's why we decided on the dragon, and it's actually a very small dragon on the cover, not a big one, fire breathing like the one he mentioned in that Shrek.
Whatever China is, small is not the right adjective. But
at least it appears on the cover of the book.
Let's talk though about China's image of itself and how that relates to other people's image of China. Do you think there is a huge mismatch?
Yeah, I think so. What we try to project overseas, you look at our media, China Daily, Beijing Review, CCTV9, all these internationally oriented media, the image that they try to project overseas is quite different from what actually is perceived of China by many international publics. So you look at survey data, this shows very convincingly that China has been very poorly perceived in many countries. So that's why we are spending billions of dollars in, you know, polishing up our media branch of our government. Also, that's why we're building up so many Confucius Institutes around the world. We are exporting Chinese culture.
Professor Sun, we've spoken a lot about how other people view China. When China looks at itself in a mirror, what does it see?
I think we all have what we call multiple selves. You know, probably you have, I like the American movie, the good and bad and the ugly. Mostly Chinese behavior are good, sometimes are bad, sometimes are ugly. That's, I think, natural development because of timing of historical evolution. Because, for example, China's relation with North Korea. Not always good, but if you consider the big strategic background, when a lot of Chinese people see the United States trying to contain China, trying to build up military forces in Asia and Pacific region, then you understand why China is trying to get, you know, closer relationship with North Korea.
Jeff Dyer, China's image of itself compared to other people's image of China.
I think this issue is most acute in the military sphere. I mean, we've heard today that Chinese view their military spending as completely normal. They say the increase in military spending is no greater than the increase in other bits of government spending on health and education, and that's true. But China is now so big that even by increasing its military by this amount, it's setting up a whole series of chain reactions around the region. It's setting up a possible arms race. You're seeing the Vietnamese investing a lot more in the military. The Indians are building more aircraft carriers, the South Koreans, the Japanese. Everyone is expanding their militaries in response to what they see as a potentially threatening build-up in the Chinese military, even though many people in China don't necessarily see it that way.
John Holden?
We do have multiple personalities, and, you know, on a good day, people feel very proud of what they've accomplished here in China. On a bad day, they look around and they see nothing but problems. You look at the 12th five-year plan, you read that carefully. There's big parts of it that talk about the issues, and they're vital issues that are this government is having trouble dealing with. There's critics everywhere. So, yeah, they feel good about themselves in one way, and they like to get credit for what they've achieved. On the other hand, they're not so confident.
Another question.
My name is Manche Gdula. I'm a student here at Tsinghua, and I was just wondering, a lot of has been said about the future possible problems China will face, the depletion of resources, carbon emissions, but I was wondering about demographics, because we have a huge workforce, obviously, in China, and I was wondering what are the perspectives of that population getting older and older, and China basically facing a big demographic problem in 30, 40 years, and what maybe the government, is it aware of that problem, and what are the possible solutions?
Professor Sun?
Actually, I don't worry that at all, because if you study the age structure here, there's over 600 million people, they were born in the reform area, something like they are under 30 years old. So still, I think China has probably 15 to 20 years, what you call the dividends. To enjoy for the next two decades.
John Holden, do you think there's a demographic issue that needs to be confronted?
I don't think there is one. One of the things that's happening in the West, and certainly there's a lot of room for change here in China, is raising the retirement age. It's very low here. So you look forward many decades, you're going to be okay in China. I think this has been hyped by people. I don't quite understand why.
I go along with John. I think the Chinese government is certainly learning lessons from these riots and demonstrations in Europe. You know, they are actually talking about seriously deferring our retirement age, say now 60 to 65 or even probably older. Yeah. So otherwise you have no ways to finance all this big, you know, humongous pension payment after people retire.
Jeff?
I actually agree with all the other panelists. I mean, as Sunjay was saying, there is a potential problem a couple of decades down the line, but China does have two decades to prepare for that and to put in place a social safety network, to put in place a pension, much more robust pension system, and to potentially increase the pension rate and so on and so forth. So they do have a lot of time. Everyone knows this problem is coming. They have a lot of time to prepare for it.
Camilla Sorensen, I'm a visiting researcher at Peking University. I'd like to return to China's relations to North Korea. Several of you indicated that North Korea might right now be pushing China too much. There might be a backlash. I was wondering if you could elaborate on what are China's opportunities. I remember several years back there were a debate about whether China was actually preparing for some kind of regime change also in North Korea. Could you imagine that coming back?
Xie Tao.
Well, I think probably we go first to Professor Sun. Yeah, he may be.
Professor Sun.
I usually don't comment on this, but let me give you a historical example. When President Roosevelt, he was questioned why the United States supporting a dictator in South Africa, and in South Latin America. So he says, I know he's bastard, but he's our own bastard. So that's my answer.
We'll take that on board. Jeff Dyer.
As I mentioned before, I mean, there has been a big debate in China about whether it makes sense to be so close to North Korea. But it does seem as if the leadership has decided that they are going to back the Kim family. They're going to back the transition from the older Kim to the younger Kim. Indeed, when you had the ceremony in Pyongyang a couple of months ago where the young Kim was presented to the public, there was a very senior Chinese official on the podium right beside Kim Jong-il, so that the Chinese leadership is very much bought into this leadership transition and does look as if they are going to try and support it and underpin it going forward.
John Holden?
You know, I think it's the if you break it, you buy it kind of a syndrome. All right, so what are you going to do? You try something, it fails, then you're stuck with the consequences. So
The idea being that the regime change would be very risky for China.
It would be absolutely risky. I think the devil you know right now is perhaps better than the one you don't know.
Xie Tao, anything you want to add?
Well, not very much, but I think, you know, my own take on this is that North Korea is useful to China strategically only to the extent that we can control. We're very much absolutely sure of its own behavior and intentions. If we are not in the position of knowing what those guys are doing, then North Korea are no longer useful to China.
Another question.
Hi, my name is Xiaoli Pan. I'm a news host with the Shanghai Media Group and I'm also a current visiting scholar at Peking University School of International Studies. I would like to take the question right back to the very beginning where Mr. Lustig said, what does China think and it matters? But very quickly, our discussion went over to the topic about military power, economic challenge. I wonder if I could ask our distinguished panel the question literally, what does China think? Often we've talked about the rise of China economically, militarily, and even political might internationally, its influence. But I wonder what does our panel think about the cultural and ideological influence of China on the world? Thank you.
John Holden, would you like to start?
I'd like to answer that question by recalling an anecdote. About 9 years ago, I met with Wang Daohan, who was the Jiang Zemin, the former president's most senior advisor, a very learned, very brilliant man. And I asked him, what does China want in the future? And I said, the problem for Americans and other people is in understanding China, we don't know where you're going. And he says, you're right. We don't explain it very well. He says, I'm writing an article for Foreign Affairs, the CFR publication, and I'll explain it. I said, great. You have any trouble? No, I can get it published. And he didn't do that. He eventually, though, his successor, the advisor, did publish something. But the problem with China is that this is a highly practical regime, and the culture is highly practical. We call it gongli-zhuyi. It's this kind of, not to say this in English, it's utilitarianism in a sense. And so you don't know where you're going to be 5 years from now. If you ask the chairman president of General Electric, where are you going to be 5 years now? He'll get so roughly in that direction, but will I know what my budget's going to be 5 years from now? You'll say, no, I don't know.
Xie Tao, is there a long-term vision, do you believe, among China's leadership as to where they want the country to be, what kind of a country they want it to be 15, 20 years down the line?
Well, as much as I personally want to know, but they don't tell me. I think that's a problem for many outside observers of China. Transparency, transparency. They cry for transparency. You know, probably your intentions are benign. You are really friendly. But if you keep everything in a secret, you know, if you shout everything, discussions, whatever, you know, legislative sessions, everything in the secret, and then people begin to doubt your intentions, even if you are benign. That's why many people are crying for transparency in China. And also back to this cultural, attractiveness or whatever. You look at survey data, for example, the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. They do a soft power survey in 2008. I believe you look at all these indicators, China lies far, far below South Korea, Japan, United States. There's no cultural attractiveness. For example, you ask parents, how many of them are going to send their kids over to Tsinghua and Peking, even though I'm very happy to see so many of them are actually studying here. But if you ask them how many are going to send your kids over to China for undergraduate education, only about 3%, if you trust the polls, of course.
Sunja, do you know, do you think anybody knows what China's vision of its future is?
I think the Chinese people are very positive. But there's there's a debate whether China, what's kind of a, talking about the China's rise? What's, do you mean the rise of the capitalism or rise of socialism, what does it mean for social characteristics of social, Chinese socialism? I think I do see there's a tendency, there's a moving trend of transformation of Chinese culture. I wonder if you have watched the Supergirls, you know, the Chinese show. Watch it. There's some kind of this young guys, young people. I think they're very dynamic. Sometimes really shares similar characteristics with Western youth. I want it now. So I think if they want democracy, if they want some other things, they would try to change the country, make new contribution for the future. So.
Jeff Dyer, if you had to write a book with the title What China Thinks, what would the first chapter say, do you think?
Well, I think what we're seeing at the moment is a big change in China's behavior and the way it deals with the rest of the world. The instinct for the last couple of decades is to keep its head down, not to get involved in too many new commitments overseas, and just to concentrate on growing the economy. And for all sorts of reasons, that's beginning to change. You have a lot of pressure from below in Chinese society. You have a very strong internet population, often very nationalistic. You have big Chinese companies, state-owned companies that have huge investments overseas. You have local governments who have big interests overseas. Those people, those pressure from below is pushing the government to be more assertive, to take more positions, to try and increase its influence overseas. And you have a leadership as well that's been constantly told you're the new superpower, you're now the second most important country in the world. They also want to try and transform that into leverage. And sometimes it's working and sometimes it isn't working.
But when you describe some of that pressure as very nationalistic, how does that then transfer into policy? What does that mean, nationalistic, in that context?
Well, we've just had an example with this case with Japan, where China, a Japanese Coast Guard arrested a Chinese fishing boat captain at a disputed island. There's a huge amount of pressure from China. A lot of people in Japan thought they were being bullied into releasing this Japanese, into releasing the fishing boat captain. At one stage, China was accused of having blocked exports of certain types of commodities to Japan. There was a very, very strong diplomatic campaign. A lot of that was because of pressure from below or an attempt by the government to get ahead of popular opinion and not be accused of being weak in the face of Japan. That's some of the kinds of things we are starting to see in Chinese policy.
Another question.
Good afternoon, panel. My name is Valerie, and actually I'm a Singaporean doing my undergraduate studies with Peking University. It's true that I believe that all the world is trying to know about China, and I believe that's why Singapore sent like people like me here over to like understand about the culture. And it's also very true that this is my second year here. And I believe that I don't really actually understand about the culture, and I feel like it's a very mysterious culture. And with interaction with like some of my friends, there were a few incidents whereby my Chinese friends actually said to me, "You are a Chinese as well, and your ancestors actually came from China. When China grew to a point whereby it's strong enough, would you feel that Singapore or Singaporeans want to return to China?" I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, it's a very individual, like, conversation, as in a very personal conversation, but it's kind of scary to me that is there this intention, like, in the Chinese that when I grow strong and big enough, like, there is this intention to get all the people of the same roots together again. Like, that's one of my questions. And what I feel is that we all know that the Chinese may not be very tactful in their dealings in like the foreign affairs, for example, like the border issues. Yes, you may be strong and certain like in your interests, but I believe that you can be tactful about it. So like, I would like to ask the panel and probably Sir John Holden, because you're in the public relations kind of group kind of thingy, is there like a certain, for example, like the recent issues, what is your advice? Like how can China better like deal with situations like these? Yeah, thank you very much.
John Holden, before we get on to how can they deal with it, let me ask you this. Do they care what people think? Do they care about their image?
Absolutely. And this is why the Confucius Institutes are being set up, why China is establishing its own global network of
media networks. What's the purpose of those institutes?
It's to grow its soft power, quite clearly. So they care. There's no question about that. When you look at the questions of how do you handle a particular incident, you know, in the PR industry, we handle crisis communications for people. So something blows up and you try to explain to a CEO how do they handle it. It's amazing the kinds of different reactions people have. They get emotional. They're responding to a bunch of unseen forces. Some handle it beautifully, and many often do not, because under the press of time, people make mistakes. So I think there's a learning process here, and I do agree that the netizens are important. I'll give you an example. The recent issue about whether or not the South China Sea is a core interest for China. I spoke with a friend of mine here in the government about that, and they said, you know, we don't really think we said it that explicitly. You know, we don't. That isn't our policy, but it all got out on the net. And so now do we want to say it's not a core interest? So it's a PR issue for them at this point. And, of course, it's an international incident as well.
Professor Sun, does it worry you what China's image is, both among its neighbors and further afield?
No. For example, I think China has a natural affinity with your country. And by the way, when you think about the graduate study, come to Tsinghua. I'll try to find a boyfriend from mainland, so you can learn more about Chinese culture. And I think Singapore serves as a role model for China in the whole reform area. Deng Xiaoping appreciated it. I think China especially appreciates Singapore model of the style of management. But however, I think China should learn from Singapore about the enforcement of tough laws.
Jeff.
There is an almost obsession sometimes in China with soft power, this idea that somehow China can influence diplomacy, influence world events through the force of its culture. And so what you have is a government-inspired initiative through the Confucius Institutes, through taking things like Chinese television and the Xinhua Agency abroad, investing huge amounts of money so that they can take on the BBC and CNN. And China likes to think that by doing this, it can somehow mold opinions, mold perceptions of China. I think this is a very, very flawed approach. I don't think governments create soft power. I think soft power results from people generally admiring a society. That's what American soft power comes from. It's not something that governments can necessarily create. The things that people admire about China are the kind of can-do spirit, the infrastructure, the way it's developed so quickly. Those are things that can influence perceptions about China, but I don't think it's something that a government committee can just write a report and decide we're going to create this image for ourselves around the world.
Xie Tao, do you think China has an image problem?
Of course I do. I do think we have an image problem. But I think, again, the question for the Chinese government and many Chinese observers, how good is China's good neighbor policy? We have been talking about this good neighbor policy for many years, since, early 1950s. So how good is our good neighbor policy? Second, we've been seeing a number of these Confucius Institutes, these cultural offensives, what some journalists call the charm offensive, right? Launched by the Chinese government. But I think that raises up another question. What's a rush to the great leap forward to public diplomacy? We are seeing a great leap forward to public diplomacy on a scale that is very much unprecedented in history. Even you go back to the U.S., the Office of Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy, you look at the U.K. and many other countries, they do have PR campaigns. But in terms of the amount of resources committed, a number of the institutes established outside, it's just unprecedented. But then you have to evaluate its effectiveness. To what extent your image, your message is actually received and actually appreciated by the target audience. So I think that's two questions. One, how good is our good neighbor policy? Second, why the rush or great leap forward to public policy?
Yeah. I can take one more question.
Hi, I'm Jiren Han from Peking University. I'm doing my master's at Peking University. And last year I heard Wen Jiabao said that China still has 50 to 100 years to go, same as Sun Zhi professor. And yesterday at Peking University there was also a Harvard professor, Ian Johnston, who talked about different indicators of how China will be developing, or like China's rise. So when China talks about, China says that there's still 50 to 100 years, is it really just to console all these people who are worried about China's rise, or is it just mainly to, you know, just is it really, what is the real indicator of what when that Chinese government says, like they have 50 to 100 years? Also, another question is, I'm from South Korea, so yesterday that incident happened on that little island, and a lot of the Chinese media, I mean Korean media, think look towards China to do something about it. But so what do you think the Chinese government will do? Just, I don't know. It's a really broad question.
Jeff Dyer, 50 to 100 years to do what? To become what?
I mean, the big underlying question that on China's rise that we haven't really talked about a lot today is the question of the political system and whether China will remain a one-party state or not. I think when Chinese leaders talk about these phrases about 50 years, it's a way of fending off the pressure to really talk now about how and when they're going to change the political system. There is a lot of pressure in Chinese society to do that. There's a lot of people within the Communist Party who want to do that, but it's very hard politically to do that. There's also a lot of opposition, and this current leadership of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, they've been in power for 8 years. They haven't really advanced that agenda at all so far. But that is going to be the big question that's going to affect China's relations with the U.S. It's going to affect China's image around the world. It's going to affect the kind of society that China is. That's going to be the big question, and it's not going to be something that's going to happen 50 years. It's going to happen in the next 10 or 20 years.
Sunjo?
I think over the last 30 years, there's some kind of China experienced what I call the triple transitions. As you begin to open up the reform, to learn from what is called market economy. Secondly, the urbanization, because people want to move into big city or others, you see the process. And thirdly, the impact of globalization. I think China will continue to experience that kind of hard transition in the next 20 or 30 years because there are probably over, some people say, over 350 million people living under $1 a day. That's over 100 million immigrants, people from rural area. They work now, work in big cities. So if you study the, would urge you to study the domestic problem. So that's why the China put up a slogan of scientific development. We need to solve all these problems first. So that takes 50 to 100 years.
John Holden, 50 to 100 years, where?
Yes, well, that is a... When I hear that, I kind of think that they're talking about standard of living of Western Europe and North America. But I do agree with Jeff. I think the big question is going to be, what is the next major iteration of China's reform and going forward? And I think the big topic has to do with the political system. I was at the party school a couple of years ago on a conference talking about that. So people are talking about it. They say they don't want American-style democracy. They don't say they don't want democracy. They want more democracy, yes. So what is that going to mean? It's going to be fascinating. We've had 3 decades, each one more surprising than the next in many ways. So put on your seatbelts.
Xie Tao, take us through the next 5 decades.
Oh, I think, you know, we're present in for the future, right? So it's very hard to be prophets. And I think, you know, you either slap in your own face or, you know, you become, you know, celebrity overnight. But I think, you know, if I were to analyze China's future, analyze China's status now, I would look at it from 3 aspects. Power, institutions, and values or norms. So you look at power, economic power, probably from a scale of 1 to 5. China is now either 4+, close to 5. Military power, maybe 3+ or something like that. But you look at the institutions, China maybe get a score of 2 or 3. You look at the values and norms, universal values, values that are widely accepted by the international community, we're probably either in the very bottom or we're 1 to 2. So that's how I would do such kind of evaluation if I were to predict China, either to say something about China today or 50 years from now.
I'm afraid that is where we must leave it. My thanks, therefore, to our panel, to Professor Sun Jie of the Center for U.S.-China Relations here at Tsinghua University, to Professor Xie Tao of Beijing Foreign Studies University, John Holden, and Jeff Dyer of the Financial Times. My thanks, too, of course, to our audience and to our hosts, the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy. That's the world tonight. This is Robin Lustig in Beijing. For now, from me, good night, and have a good weekend.